jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little low, by golly. Then we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By Jiminy, please don't bother me. So they all went away singing, oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jub, by jingo.
Hello and welcome to the American Writers 100 Pages at a Time podcast. And in this episode, officially I'm supposed to talk about book three of The Outsider, Descent, which is what it's called. And it's the shortest of the five books in this work. It's not uneventful. It's just... it's just short. It is key. It is clear what Richard Wright is trying to do in this section. And to be honest, it's a bit of a retread of stuff we've seen in Black Boy. And I guess that's kind of what I want to talk about. So halfway through this novel, I think let's just kind of sit back and I think here's kind of what I want to say. I think I know why this novel's not as well liked and didn't get as good of reviews as Native Son or Black Boy or some others, his other works. Now, as I said before, this was actually the first work of his that I was aware of, and I don't know why that was. Obviously, I didn't read it till now, but I was aware of this book called The Outsiders by this Black writer, Richard Wright, and I thought of it often in the same way of like The Invisible Man, right? Ellison's book. And of course, Richard Wright and Ellison were friends. Didn't Ellison attend his wedding or something? So they were close. And, you know, thematically, they seemed similar. Maybe that's why I heard about it. Someone was talking about these two books together. But I never actually read it. And then when I started reading it, you know, and I was looking up and I couldn't find like LibriVox recordings of it. Maybe that's because it's not public domain yet, but I couldn't find very much being written about it. You know, not much reflection. There wasn't anything on YouTube. And of course, there weren't adaptations like there were of Native Son. Now, it kind of struck me like, why not? And the novel certainly has an interesting thread. But I think when you get to this section, Descent, this book three, you're starting to experience some of the problems with Wright's some issues with Wright's approach of writing, how he's writing at this point in his career and this point in his life. So by the time this was written, Wright has already exiled himself to France, right? And he's turned his back on communism. He's embraced existentialism, but he's an outsider. He's away from his country. He's an outsider in France. He's rejected, and of course, Black Boy talks about his breakup with the Communist Party in quite gut-wrenching detail. And this is, of course, written even after that. So this is right almost 10 years after Black Boy was written. Black Boy was written in 45, Outsider in 1953. So he's, you know, the whatever nostalgia he had for his participation in the communist movement, that comes off in Black Boy. Because Black Boy reads like especially the American Hunger part of it, reads like a tragic breakup, right? A very, very sad breakup. This, 10 years later, is written from a much more like cynical and kind of crude look at this. So the party is presented here just in a very unappealing way. And the descent here is almost like the descent of the party. Not really of Cross yet. Of course, we'll get into that a little bit more as we read. But really the heart of book three, Descent, is Damon Cross's, our character's, split with communism over like different personalities involved in his relationships with people are at the heart of it. So anyways, let's try to talk about what happens here. So the breakup with communism here is like, it's like literal violence at the end. So Damon Cross commits his second murder at the end of book three, Descent. And why? It's almost like there's no real purpose for this murder. Kind of like if you think back, the murder at the end of book one, Dread, there's not that much purpose for it either. It's like, all right, he's like relieved he can be another person after the freak accident. And then he runs into someone he knows, and he's like, you know, a rational person, I suppose, a normally motivated person would say, well, I guess I can't run away. I've been spotted. Or maybe talk to him about it and see if he goes along with it or something, or something else. But no, Damon Cross just decides to straight up murder him. And the murder here also kind of, like, it's almost like he's feeling slighted by the fact that he was, like, unable to control his entire, like, participation in the Communist Party, I guess. Maybe I'll get more to that. This is going to be a pretty disjuncted, non-linear kind of approach to this. Because I'm partially trying to make sense of it, and you're my my witnesses to me trying to make sense of, like, this book in this context. But, like, the communists, here's the thing. The communists in Uncle Tom's Children and in Native Son and in Black Boy was hopeful, was something that he longed to see actualized, right? Like, the ideological solution to a lot of his problems and something, like, meaningful and attractive to him. In practice, it had its faults that forced him to break up with it. That's what we get in Black Boy. It's internal authoritarianism was a primary focus. The inability of him, really it comes down to his inability to be an authentic, true to himself writer while also maintaining the party line. Okay, he doesn't seem to have rejected its goals, right? The Communist Party here is just like subterfuge and trickstery and manipulation and deceit. And it's kind of like just straight up a scam. And that's what we get. He's like almost scammed into it. Now, Damon Cross thinks, you know, well, I can sort of control this, right? Because there is a point made that somehow this is the most likely to succeed. But it's all presented as bad faith. Remember, this is an existentialist novel. So the, you know, bad faith is kind of the existentialist idea of it's self-deception, essentially, or cognitive dissonance, if you will. But the existentialist term for that, I think it comes from Sartre. And it means, like, accepting how others see you as who you are, right? Accepting, I guess, isn't the example Sartre gives of bad faith the waiter, right? The waiter who takes on the persona of the ideal waiter, right? And so he just becomes the waiter, like almost the archetype of the waiter, and loses himself. And it's, this is a type of deception against, and that's how the novel, or part three, begins. It begins with this idea of bad faith. He says, I have accepted their invitation in bad faith. He had accepted their invitation to communism in bad faith. And of course he's living with these communists, the Blouts, and he's also joining up with the party, essentially. He had accepted their invitation of bad faith, which was now almost in congenital condition with him, but he realized that his adversaries were also acting in bad faith, a bad faith which they were cynically proud. Bad faith, though reprehensible and regrettable, was not unknown to Cross. Not only had he been long guilty of it in his personal relations, but he was convinced that bad faith, of some degree, was an indigenous part of living. The daily stifling of one's sense of terror in the face of life, the far-flung conspiracy of pretending that life was tending towards the goal of redemption, the reasonless assumption that one's dreams and desires were realizable, all of these outwardly human feelings were bad faith, end quote. Okay, I dig it. That's all bad faith. All that stuff is bad faith. But, like, so his hopelessness is just like, oh, I might as well do some murders because anything else is bad faith. I really don't quite know, honestly, what Richard Wright's trying to say here. And I'm kind of bothered by this in this novel. But anyways, he sorts of somehow think, and of course we're told straight up, this is bad faith. It's not like in Native Son where we have to kind of work out emotionally what our character's feeling. We're just told straight up, you know, through using the language of existentialism, that this is... this is why he's doing it. No need money. He was pulling for it. It was like, you know, he thinks he can control this situation. He thinks he can control his membership in the party and what it means. So anyways, he's with this couple living with them. And through his experience, he learns about manipulation, particularly through the diary of Ava, who he finds her diary, who's like one of the people he's living with, right? He's living with this couple, and the diary shows all the manipulation, everything that Gil Blount was doing to manipulate Ava Blount to keep her in the party and get her to do different things. Again, it's all, the party itself is deception. Damon is self-deceived himself, we're told explicitly in the text with his bad faith. So, I get it. He's pretending, right? It's this conspiracy of pretending, we're told. But that means we never can know Damon Cross's true motives, I guess. We're told explicitly that he is in bad faith. We're not told explicitly, like, why he did this. We're not even told, like, implicitly. It's not even clear why he did this. He's just sort of moving to, all right, where to go from here? Well, I'm kind of all over the place, but we need to get at the murder of these communists because that's the central event of part three. But also, its lack of motivation is what's a little bit off-putting, I suppose. But we can try to get at his motives a little bit in this section, or at least how he's thinking about communism. But sometimes when you read this, you're thinking, this is just Richard Wright pontificating on his views on this. So he understood, okay, excitement grew in him. He felt that he was beginning to look at the emotional skeleton of man. He understood now the hard communist insistence on strict obedience and things that had no direct relation to politics proper or to their keeping tight grasp on the reins of power. Once a thorough system of central power had its way of life, had gotten hold of a man's heart to the extent that it could order and define all his relations, it was bound to codify and arrange all of life's activities into one organic unity. So he seems to be support. This is an old theme we've gotten before in Richard Wright, is somehow totalitarianism being a means of like finding meaning in the world, kind of by giving it to you in a way. But going on, the systemizing of the central impulses of man to be a god must needs to be jealous of all economic or all rival systems of sensuality, even those found in poetry and music. Cross, lying on his bed and staring at the ceiling, marveled at the astuteness of both communism and fascist politicians who had banned the demonic contagions of jazz. And now, too, he could understand why the communists, instead of shooting the capitalists and bankers, as they had so ardently sworn that they would do when they came to power, made instead, with blood in their eyes, straight for the school teachers, priests, writers, poets, musicians, and the deposed bourgeois government rulers as the men who held for them the deadliest of threats to their keeping and expanding their power. End quote. So this is obviously a very, very cynical reading of a big chunk of 20th century history, and a little reductive, and it's definitely influenced by like the totalitarian the idea of totalitarianism, which is something that emerged after World War II as a way to try to group fascism and communism into one kind of one bad force in the world, right? I guess the older term would have been authoritarianism, but totalitarianism was definitely a post-war, Cold War era concept. And this is the idea rejected by most historians now, as far as I know, is that totalitarianism is defined by the way it's here, that all, like the mind of the man is controlled entirely by the state, by the system. But anyways, let's take it for what it is in the text. He saw now that those who, in trying to rationalize their fears of communism, had said that the practice of communism was contrary to human nature, was naive or blind to awful facts, with which they could not have the courage to admit. For as Cross could see, there was not perhaps on earth a system of governing men which was more solidly built upon the sadly embarrassing cupidities of the human heart and its hunger to embrace the unembraceable. Of course, the system of sensualization The concept of power did not prevail alone in the communist or fascist world. The communists had merely rationalized it, brought it nakedly and seemingly into the open, end quote. Anyways, even if I grant all of this is true of the Soviet Union, which, as I suggested, historians question. They look at the Soviet Union more complex now that they have access to the archives, and they see subjectivity in the, you know, and diversity of opinions and political conflicts. Totalitarianism is just a model that does not fit the historical record. Even if we grant it of the Soviet Union, he's talking about communism as an active social movement in the United States, which obviously was modeled off of the Marxist-Leninist tradition and certainly had its trials and its expulsions and its... And Wright himself was felt mistreated by the communist movement and not able to express himself fully, blah, blah, blah. But they don't have power. They are not in control, not even close, right? What power is this that Damon Crosshair is so obsessed with? The petty tyranny of these guys who like run this local branch of like six dudes who are like the local Communist Party member. It's kind of like when you watch The Sopranos and you see the decline of that subculture into just like three dudes at outside of the meat market at the end of the series, you know, waiting to be arrested by the police. It's, you know, what, maybe in Chicago there was 1,000 communists, maybe. I don't know. We don't really get numbers. And then really all he's interacting with is these two dudes and the guy's wife. And it's like, where is he getting this like interpretation of the communists' place in history? You know, where is this really coming from, I guess? And I suggested before in the, you know, we learn about this in part two, that he seems to be not unaware about communist history. I just find it weird. To again, if you want to grant that for the Soviet Union, total totalitarian system that asserted total control over the minds of every person, right? Was that the Communist Party in America? Anything close to that? Maybe. The stuff I've read, like Robin Kelly's book on the Communist Party in the South, which is actually quite relevant to this because he was interested in, those are mostly black. Robin Kelly's writing mostly about black people in the South who joined the Communist Party. That's not the experience that they reported on, according to that book. Again, my point is not to say Wright is wrong to turn on communism at this point in his life. He had his reasons. They're all explored on Black Boy. My complaint here is like, this is a little bit of a demented way of looking at the world through Damon Cross. Now, maybe that's one way to read it, but I don't think Richard Wright really wants us to feel that way about him. I mean, on some level, he must want us to sympathize with him. Otherwise, he wouldn't write this whole book about him. I mean, Bigger Thomas is an easier character to kind of understand, I think. And I think this existentialism is kind of like not helping his writing, frankly. I don't know. Maybe I'm complaining too much. But he then, as I said, he sees Ava Blount's diary, and he finds out how oppressive the party is, which is something Damon Cross apparently already knows. Cross closed the diary. This is what we get after he reads the diary. And it's all sorts of about how like black people are being manipulated by the party. That's the heart of this diary. And then he says, Cross closed the diary, and now you learn something of Ava's life. He did not want to read anymore. He knew enough to make a numbing sense of recognition to go through him. Impulsively, he wanted to run to her and talk to her to tell her that she was not alone, but that was foolish. Secrecy was how the world was run. Millions felt alike, but were ashamed to admit it. Here was a lost, brave woman who had enough sensitivity and intelligence to understand what was to be said. She was a victim like he. The difference was that he was a willing victim and she was an involuntary one. She protested, and he said yes, and a world yawned between him, his yes, and her no. Again, that's like even just hard to read, much less like grok fully. But, you know, the diary just documents Ava's like decline as the Communist Party takes over more of Gil's life, and it imposes on her. So, anyways, next we get the murder is the next scene. So, Gil Blount is fighting with this other communist guy. And he comes in. Let's find the passage here. Well, he hears the fighting downstairs. He's upstairs with Ava, and he hears the fighting downstairs. So he goes down there, and this is what happened. So he quickly went into the hall. He realized that he went down the steps. He was acting more of a kind of proxy for the feelings of Ava than his own. I really don't care, he thought. He reached the landing on the first floor. He paused, and he came to his ears the sound of grunts, scuffling feet, and the thud of blows. He crept on tiptoes to the door and placed his ear to the panel. Yes, they were fighting. Was the door locked? He turned the knob. The door swung in, and Cross looked at the two men grappling with each other. Gil lashed out with his right fist, bashing Herdon a crushing blow on the ear and sending him reeling backwards. Herdon collided with the table, and when he turned, Cross could see that he had a fire poker in his hand. Cross looked quickly at Gil and saw that he was not what he had first looked at. He saw what he's not first seen when he looked in the room. Gil was bloodied, his face covered with reddish streaks where the fire poker had ripped into his flesh. Both men were oblivious to Cross, who stood at the doorway with a bitter smile on his face. Cross could barely contain his bubbling glee as he watched the battle. Which man did he hate more? Many times during the past 24 hours he had wished both of them dead, and now he was looking at them batter each other's brains out. Let them fight, he said to himself. Let them fight, right? Like Godzilla. He spun round at the sound of footsteps behind him on the stairs. Eva was descending with wild eyes, her hair flying behind her. He grabbed her shoulders and held her, wanting to keep her out of the room. Ava twisted loose and ran to the doorway. Cross followed and stood behind her. Ava grabbed hold of both jambs of the door and screamed when she saw Gil sinking to the floor under the blows of Herndon's fire poker. So anyways, there's a bunch more to read, but so this is the scene he walks in on of these two fighting, and then he just grabs, I think it's a table leg, and just kills Herdon, and then Gil turns around and kills Gil. So he just kills these two people who are in the midst of this big fight, kind of out of just hatred for them. That's what the text says. The text says he hates them, and he's doing it on behalf of Ava in a way, or projecting Ava's beliefs, or desires, or frustrations, or whatever she's feeling. And here's what he says at the end. I killed, well, he doesn't say he thinks it. It's internal monologue. I killed two little gods. He paused, frowning. But they would have killed me, too, if they found me like that. Yes, he could not get it straight. Just a moment ago, it all seemed so simple. But now it was knotted and complicated. There was in him no regret for what he had done. No, not at all. But how could he have done it? He, too, had acted like a little god. He had stood amidst those red and flickering shadows, tense and consumed with cold rage, and had judged them and found them guilty of insulting his sense of life and had carried out a sentence of death upon them. Like Hilton and Gil, he acted towards Bob, so he had acted towards Gil and Herdon. He had assumed the role of policeman, judge, Supreme Court, and executioner all in one swift and terrible moment. So that's what we get. He kills them because they're little gods. And again, I'm back to this idea of like, this kind of exaggerated view of what the communists in America in this period were. It was a left-wing social movement that did some organizing, right? And it didn't amount to much. I mean, I read Robin Kelly's book about Hammer and Hoe, about the communists in Alabama, and they did good work. Maybe they pushed the New Deal, because there was sort of a threat. It was a movement on the streets, organizing in factories. It did work. It did anti-racist work. The history I've read on this does not present it as just like manipulative criminals and tyrants, like petty tyrants joining up. I think, again, if I'll eat that description of the Soviet Union. It's not hard to accept that, but it's... American communists were always kind of doing their own thing, right? They had their own like agendas and movements and culture behind them. And I think right is really embittered. It's like if Black Boy is like the sad breakup, the reflection on the breakup that had to be, this is like someone 10 years later writing a really, really embittered response. He literally kills he has his character kill the two like organizers of the communist organizers that were trying to recruit Damon Cross and trying to move into the party. So it's, I don't know what to make sense of this. Maybe in the context of the book, we're going to get a little bit more. I don't know. Anyways, the next section of the book is called Despair. And then we have Decision as the last one. And I know, like with Native Son, the end of the book ends with like the law being involved, right? And him, you know, having to come to terms with like the end of his life in the context of like the legal reaction to what he did. So we'll talk about that and we'll when we get there. But yeah, I'm kind of at a loss of what to make of this book at this point. It's maybe it's just a section. I hope it like redeems itself and convinces me of, you know, of what it's trying to say, or just is more clear on what it's trying to say in the next section. So it's called Despair, and it's going to pick up just with the aftermath of this dual murder. So anyways, I guess that's it for now. Sorry for being a little disjointed and unclear of what to make of this. It's just this book kind of threw me in this section a little bit. I mean, I guess I was feeling some of it in the first two sections, but I had a lot of faith in Richard Wright from his other works, but I'm not sure what to do at this point with this book. So I'm gonna finish it up though, and come back to you in a few days with my thoughts on Despair, for book four of The Outsider. So anyways, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
And every night they sang in the pale moonlight. Oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jaw. Oh, by jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little, oh, by gollies. Then we'll put them in the follies.